Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for August 29th, 2010. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, welcome from Atlanta.
Yes, and welcome, Ian.
Good evening, sir.
Yeah, I tell you what, this week, even considering we had two or three primaries in the South, it was kind of a quiet week for politics. But the good news is we've got some really good guests to, give us a good show. Late in the hour, we're going to have Jason Means of the Chick-fil-A Bowl and, I believe, Chick-fil-A kickoff game, and he'll be joined along with Barbecue Bob Herndon, head of the Atlanta Barbecue Club. They're going to come on about 7:45. But early in the show, we have a really big guest from the Hedgehog Report, and Tim, I'm going to let you tell more about his background as an introduction.
Oh, yes, Mr. David Wissing will be on with us here in about 10 minutes, the administrator and the guy who started one of the biggest national blogs in the country, and we're really looking forward to talking today.
Yeah, so that'll be good. Maryland's kind of a border state, so I guess it's close enough where we can talk about it. But in the meantime, there's some stuff going on and a lot of directions we can go in. But I think we ought to go ahead and start with these two new ads in the Georgia governor's race, one a 30-second ad and one a 15-second ad. And I went ahead, I think Melanie Gu posted them both on Blog for Democracy, and I actually commented, I'm not a fan of 15-second ads, but I actually liked this one. Usually you can't make your point in 15 seconds, but this point was pretty clear about tax records on Nathan Deal, and it was made, and they can save some money. Catherine, did you see it, and what'd you think of it?
I saw both of them, and I thought they were good. And I understand that they've done a pretty big online ad buy, so we'll be seeing them, in Google ads and, on the New York Times site. And so I think it was a smart move to do those short ads and, put them in prominent locations around the internet. I think it was a smart move on the Burns team.
Yeah, but now the New York Times, not the AJC, or both?
I don't know.
I mean,
I don't know where all.
Yeah, I mean.
But I heard though. I heard Rolling Stone and New York Times.
Huh, that's kind of curious. In that, I mean, to me, I would go with some of my local papers throughout the state: the Savannah Morning News, Romney's Tribune.
Well, I don't know. They may have bought those too. I didn't hear
whole
buy.
I'm sure that there are a decent number of New York Times readers, but I have a funny feeling that people that read the New York Times online, and I actually download the podcast every week, but those are the kind of folks that probably know how they vote. They're not real swing voters. I mean, they're decided one way or the other. So I would definitely press upon those folks, Barnes team, to consider Georgia papers that just your average voter is going to look at. But, Tim, did you see the 15-second ad? What did you think?
Yeah, I did. His campaign is staying with the hard-hitting attack ads. I think they're direct, right to the point, and he gets his money's worth in 15 or 16 seconds or whatever it was. I wonder how effective these are going to be. Who is his target audience? Is it independents and wavering Republicans, or is it to stir up the party base, or what is the purpose? Because what I keep seeing are attack ads.
Well, that's because of the numbers. He's behind. He has to bring Nathan Deal down. Now, the nice thing about 15-second ads, especially if you could find another ad that was a different ad, a lot of times you can book in an ad segment. You can put a 15-second ad on, a bunch of other commercials run, and then do another 15-second. You bought it like 30, and then people coming in of a show and coming back from a show, those are probably the most likely to be viewed ads of the ad block. So I think that could be a real good strategy.
You say he wants to bring him down, but both of them right now, and all the polling I'm seeing, are in the 40s. Nobody is at the magic 50%. So, you know, how long does this strategy work, do you think?
Well, here's the thing I fear, and we probably need to talk about the 30-second ad, too. What if he does this and does this and does this, and Nathan Deal never comes down? I mean, then the fear would be, what can you do? I mean, because there are voters in Georgia that you could say one guy raped women, pillaged villages, did everything wrong, and the other guy has a D beside his name, and the demon is the guy with a D beside his name.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That's my fear. There are voters in Georgia. We'll talk about it later with Louisiana. It doesn't matter what the facts of the two people are. They don't vote for the person. They definitely vote for the party, irregardless of what the people involved have done. So,
right.
I mean, if you don't see these numbers move, I don't know what your next tact is.
Well, I think what Tim isn't saying, but might be thinking, is that in conjunction with these negative attack ads, he also needs to, sort of clarify what he stands for and what he's going to do. I think, you know, those of us inside baseball kind of understand that he's got a lot of good ideas about jobs and, you know, he's experienced and all those things, but he needs to talk about that a little bit too, not just about how evil Nathan Deal is. And he should be able to do both.
And you could even do that. Why can't you? I mean, I don't know if there's a 15-second ad that can be a positive ad, but if you could find that 15-second ad that was just Roy Barnes created X number of jobs last time he was in, put him back to work, and you could then do 15 and 15 positive, negative. I mean, I think he does have it. I think we've said this before. We all agree this. He has to build himself up at some point, too. He has to say, look, I'm a doer. The other party's not. But maybe he's thinking, let's see if these ads, and they're doing internal polls, which we don't have, and there's probably much more polling data. But if he can see these numbers, right now it's like 46-41. If at some point it goes 43-43 or 44-44, maybe that's the trigger moment where these ads that are in the can that are positive, maybe those come on. I mean, they may have some strategy there that we haven't been privy to. Now that
well, I certainly hope they do.
Yeah, I mean, we have no strategy. I mean, nobody ever accuses, you know, Roy Barnes, Bobby Kahn of not having a strategy. I mean, that's you pretty much assume that's a given. Now, that 30-second ad, not that the content was any, you know, more compelling than anything else, but one thing I noticed is the ad that was posted on Blog for Democracy was paid for by Roy Barnes for governor. Now, I saw that ad on the high school football show on Channel 36, probably a real good spot, by the way, for an ad, just thinking about how that's the kind of folks that, you know, probably are going to go to vote that actually support local schools and that kind of stuff. But on that ad, at the end of it, it was paid by the Democratic Party of Georgia and actually had a Daryl Hicks tag, making it a coordinated campaign. And I've always seen, you know, ads that were paid for by the Democratic Party of Georgia, but never the same ad being used in two different contexts. Had y'all seen that before?
I haven't noticed.
No.
Yeah, I mean, this one, it was on, and it said very clearly, Democratic Party of Georgia, and then it had vote Daryl Hicks, Labor Commissioner, because you have to have two campaigns to make it a coordinated campaign. A lot of times what they'll do is they'll cross over, they'll have federal and state, because I was surprised it wasn't Michael Thurman at the end, but that has something to do with using federal funds, and if you want to use federal funds, that allows you to take half the money out of that pot if, then if you throw Michael Thurman's name, or you can do congressional races, but that would be kind of a waste in that you're looking at so many different congressional districts in the Atlanta media market. But it's going to be interesting to see, and I think it would be real interesting as these ads play, if people can begin to figure out a picture of what kind of ads, where is he playing his ads, what type of target demographic is he going towards.
David, I believe we have a guest with us. If you want to put him on.
Oh, I thought you were going to mute him, Tim, but he's on with us. Welcome, David. How are you doing?
Hello, how are you? Greetings from Maryland.
Well, thank you. We have with us Mr. David Wissing of the National Political Blog, The Hedgehog Report. Now, David, you've heard our show before, even though you haven't been with us. And since this is your first time to be on with us, what we like to do is ask our guests to give us a brief biography of themselves. So at this time, why don't we start off by getting you to tell us a little bit about David Wissing's life to this point.
Well, I'm a lifelong Marylander. I'm about 35 years old, so I've been a lifelong Maryland, except for a couple of years I went away to Villanova University, and so it's kind of a short version. And then politically, I guess I've been somewhat active since about 2003. I got involved in the local Maryland politics, and I've been doing that ever since. I'm currently a state central committee member for the Republican Party in Maryland.
All right. Now, it's 2004.
Yes.
And a guy that's 20-something from Villanova University is settled in Howard County, Maryland, and he has this political idea. Now, why don't you pick it up right there, Dave, and tell us how it all started with the Hedgehog Report and why?
Well, it goes back by a year before that. It was right after the 2002 election. I guess blogs are really starting to come into existence around then, probably a little earlier than that, but I was reading a lot of them over the 2002 election, and I thought it was kind of fun to read them, and I always wanted to, I always have stuff to say, so I finally decided, hey, I'm going to start one of these myself, and signed up on one of the free blogging software, and started off on blogger.com, which is a pretty big blogging platform, and from there, just kind of took off from there. I started out doing mostly, you know, picking items out of the news and just kind of giving my 2 cents worth on an article or whatever happened to be in the news. And then I've always been a poll junkie. I like watching polls. And so I started adding those to the site. And before you know it, that kind of took over the site. So it's become more of a polling site since probably around 2004, I think. I guess when you had started reading it, Tim, and getting involved.
Right, right. Now, this blog of yours where you just wanted to get on the internet and say a few things about what you thought about, you know, Howard County and Maryland politics, well, this thing has grown into one of the largest blogs in the country. Many days your number of posts are comparable to or exceed the number that, say, a site like Coast or Red State would get. Why do you think that the Hedgehog Report in Howard County, Maryland, has grown so large?
I mean, I think there's a big interest in polling. I mean, I think part of it too is there's been so much more polling this day and age than even, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. I think the internet has a lot to do with that, and you have a lot of new polling firms out there who do almost daily polling. Rasmussen Reports is an example. There's the new one, Public Policy Polling, which I mean, they may have been around for a while, but with the internet, you know, every poll they do gets put right up online, and it's all over the place. And I, being a poll junkie myself, it was one of the things I liked collecting that data, and it just made sense to put it up on the site for other people to see in kind of a central location.
Right. Now, I'm going to ask you about one more thing, and then I'm going to pass the baton over to Catherine Smith.
Okay.
You have, to say the least, an interesting array of regular posters covering every possible section of the political spectrum. You have posters from practically every state in the country. You even have regular posters from Germany and Canada. Several of these posters, like Tina, M.D., Bitterlaw, and Lisa B., have pretty much been with you since the beginning. And the four people I just mentioned all have somewhat different political philosophies. What is it about your site that makes it so unique and attracts all of these different types of political people to it?
Well, I think part of it, I mean, interest in polls, you know, that expands from the far left to the far right. And I think one of the things I do try to do on my site is I don't get too much into the ideological battles between, you know, left and right or specific issues. I mean, I have my own personal biases. I don't hide that. You know, I have my rooting. I root for the Republicans most of the time. But, you know, as far as polls, you know, the data is the data. We put it up there. And I think I don't try to, you know, persuade anybody. I just put it up there. And, you know, by the time you put a poll up on the site, you have a bunch of people dissecting it from every which direction. And I think that helps with the, you know, the diversity is, you know, no matter what your political philosophy, you want to look at the data and determine whether, you know, what you feel about that data and what it means and that sort of stuff. So, it, you know, as far as analyzing polls, I don't think it has a political bent from that point. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
I know it.
And one final little question. Have you been just a bit stunned by how big it all has gotten?
Yeah, I would say a little bit. You know, I do it as a hobby. It's not a money-making thing for me. I mean, it has been a little bonus. I have made a little bit of money off on the side with it. But, you know, to me, it's a hobby. I've always liked dealing with politics, and I like watching polls, and it's an easy way to have an outlet for that. So, yeah, it's been a little surprising, but,
Yeah, it's kind of surprising to go to like a convention or something and people say, oh, you're that guy. Yeah, isn't that a little surprising?
Yeah, it's sometimes a little overwhelming, but it's fun. And Scott,
all right.
It's introduced me to a lot of people, too, that I probably would have not been introduced to in the past. So that's the neat part.
All right. And with that, I'm going to pass it to Catherine Smith. Catherine?
Hey, David, thanks a lot for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Of course.
We welcome you, even though we are all Democrats here.
Oh, I know. I figure if Tim can come on my site and deal with all with the people he deals with, I can reciprocate.
I wanted to ask you about the Maryland governor's race.
Okay.
And what, you know, Maryland generally in the past has been is generally pretty democratic, is it not?
Yes. Yeah, I knew
and,
that.
Just wondered what your thoughts were about the race between O'Malley and Ehrlich. And also, in relating to that, is there a lot of Tea Party activity in Maryland, and how does that impact some of the local races?
Well, I guess, I mean, it's been kind of interesting. I mean, obviously, Bob Ehrlich, he was our first Republican governor in 30-some years when he was elected back in 2002. He ended up losing his reelection bid in 2006 to the current governor, Martin O'Malley. And, you know, as this election year was starting to shape up, Republicans were looking for a candidate. And unfortunately, the Republican bench in Maryland, at least on a statewide level, is not very deep. And, you know, a lot of people were begging Ehrlich to run. And, you know, being a more Republican year, I think he decided he had a chance to reclaim his old job back, so he decided to jump in the race, you know, early in the year. Well, I guess late last year is when it started to heat up, but I guess he officially announced it back in April. So everybody's been expecting a rematch for some time, and I guess we have that now. And for a while, everybody thought it was going to be Ehrlich O'Malley. There wasn't really much else going on. And then around, I guess, March or April, suddenly this new candidate came out of the blue, Brian Murphy, which I think you guys have heard about now. But for the most part, through most of the, I guess, spring and early summer, you know, not a lot of people paid attention to Brian Murphy too much. You know, Ehrlich was considered a shoo-in for the nomination. And I know O'Malley has some primary a competition, but I don't think anybody takes them too seriously. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I happen to be sitting at my desk at work, and I get a press release from Brian Murphy campaign indicating he's been endorsed by Sarah Palin, which
whoa,
kind of surprised
me. We had one of those here, too.
Yeah. So it's out of the blue, and I got it, and I think I put it right up on the site right away, just because it was, I didn't even know what to think about it at the time. I don't think it was expected by, at least, I didn't hear any rumblings about it, so I'm sure a lot of insiders might have heard about it, but, and it just so happened we had a central committee meeting that night, and I showed up, and, first thing goes, did you hear about Sarah Palin? I was like, yeah, I heard about it. Just about every person who walked in the door had the same, hey, can you believe what just happened? Yeah. Since then, it's I guess the Republican primary has gotten a little bit more news attention just because of that. So right now we have a primary in about 2.5 weeks, under 2.5 weeks. So I think everybody's curious to see what the effect of Palin's endorsement will be. Me personally, I don't think it's going to have that big an impact. I've been a little surprised over the last week. There's been a lot of, I guess what I would call the social conservative and more conservative groups have been coming out more vocally for Brian Murphy. So after seeing what happened in Alaska, it's been a little more surprising than I would have thought, and how much news attention Brian Murphy has been getting.
And what's Brian Murphy's background?
Not a lot of people know. I know he's been he's more of a businessman. I'll be honest, I haven't gone in too much detail on which businesses he's been working with. He's young. He's 33 years old. He's, I guess, more of a social conservative than Bob Ehrlich. I think Bob Ehrlich's more known as a more moderate Republican. A lot of the socialists who haven't really been his, I guess, bailiwick, but so I think a lot of conservatives, one thing about Ehrlich was when he was governor, a lot of conservatives were a little bit disappointed in him, I guess. Being the first Republican governor, I guess they were expecting stuff to happen more quickly, especially from a conservative point of view. But, part of the problem in Maryland is even when Ehrlich was governor, he was faced up against veto-proof majorities in both houses. The General Assembly, so made it very difficult for him to even if he wanted to pass conservative ideas, the General Assembly tended to shoot him down pretty quickly. So
a lot of people misunderstand those kind of things. I think that a lot of people think the president can do anything and
right.
A governor can do anything and don't really understand that they both have legislatures that they have to deal with.
The thing about Maryland, I think it's not a secret that Maryland is very, very heavily Democratic. In fact, I just looked up the voter registration numbers as of July 31st, and there's 1.9 million Democrats to just about 900,000 Republicans. So, he's already facing a 2-to-1 deficit just on that alone. So, you can't be a hardline conservative and very far in Maryland. So, But one thing about Ehrlich is he is, whatever you think about him politically, he's a very personable guy. He's well-liked. Even when he lost in 2006, his approval ratings were above 50%, which is, I think he just got swept up in the anti-Republican tide that year. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to David. David?
Huh? Yeah, I was just looking at Murphy's site. It appears having children's a hobby for him,
yeah.
Looking at his large family. But I did look on Politics One, and I noticed that in Maryland there's only two other there's only two down ballot races, Attorney General and State Comptroller, which that's a pretty low number. Why do you think Maryland only has so few down ballot races compared to other states?
Why they only have that? I don't know why. It might just been the way they set it up, 200 years ago, when the Constitution was written. The one interesting thing is in Maryland, the few down ballot races, we actually, Republicans failed to even have a candidate in the Attorney General's race. Fortunately, nobody had stepped forward. So we really have a comptroller race. There's a few people running for that. basically in Maryland. I mean, everybody's focused on the gubernatorial race. I don't think Republicans are, you know, they'll probably never say it publicly, but I don't think they really are seriously expecting to win either the controller or attorney general race. They mainly just focused on the governor's race this go around.
Yeah, and then I know that there's 8 congressional districts in Maryland. I believe the first district is very competitive. Is that, am I correct on this number?
Yeah, out of all 8 districts, that's probably the one district that is going to be competitive and the one that probably has a chance of switching hands. Right now, the delegation, 7 Democrats, 1 Republican. The one Republican represents most of Western Maryland, which tends to be much more Republican in demographics. But the other 7 districts right now are all Democratic. We did have 2008, Wayne Gilchrist was an incumbent Republican, ended up losing in the primary race to a more conservative candidate, Andy Harris. And then actually Wayne Gilchrist turned around and endorsed a Democrat in that race, Frank Cradiville, who is now the incumbent congressman, who won the seat by about 2,500 votes, if I remember correctly. But so mainly in Maryland, the 8 congressional districts, 7 of them, I don't think there's really any expectation that they're going to switch hands. If one of the Democratic seats ends up switching hands, it'll probably be a good night for Republicans, other than the first district, of course. But I think if Republicans are hoping to gain control of Congress, that first district of Maryland, that's one they're looking at. And I think it's, I mean, they have a serious opportunity to win that seat. The district, I think, went close to 20% in favor of McCain the last go around. So even in the, you know, Obama way, they still voted 20% in favor of McCain. So it's a district Republicans should be able to win. And I think this year being more favorable to Republicans is one they are counting on winning this go around.
Yeah, and we caught you before the primary, which is good. We'd like to do that with our guest. Rob Fisher and Andy Harris seem to be the two more credible Republican candidates. Which one kind of has the lead there of the two?
I mean, I don't know too much about the first district. From what everything I've heard and seen, it's Andy Harris is probably the front runner, mainly because he's mainly the establishment candidate, but he's also been endorsed by most of the conservative groups and Tea Party groups that kind of backed him. So I don't know where the base is for Fisher. Unlike the governor's race, where a lot of the more conservative groups have backed Murphy, most of these groups have backed Andy Harris in this race, and I think Andy Harris has also been supported by the establishment, which tends to be more moderate in their view. But so it's across the board, Andy Harris has been getting the support, and unless I'm missing something completely, I think Andy Harris has got that nomination, and then he'll have a rematch against Frank Cradiville. And then we'll see how that goes. I mean, obviously this time around, Cradiville's an incumbent, so Andy Harris has to get over that hurdle. I think the last poll I saw was in June, and Cradiville was actually ahead by 5%. I forget who did that poll. I think it was a Democratic polling firm, internal poll for Cradiville. But that's the last poll I've seen. And then we also have a U.S. Senate race. I don't think anybody's, you know, right now Barbara Mikulski is the incumbent. Again, if she's in any trouble, I think Republicans are going to be having a good night. But there's really 2 candidates on the Republican side who I think are considered the front runners. One is Eric Wargotz, who has most of the money in the campaign, and then there's Jim Rutledge, he seems to be the guy who's been backed by most of the Tea Party groups and conservative groups. I honestly don't know who's really ahead in that group, but I don't know if it's going to make much difference. I think Barbara Mikulski, she's won basically all her races with 60% or more, and I don't see anything changing this time around, even in a Republican year.
Yeah, I mean, and just looking, there's a ton of candidates running, and I can't even count that number of R's quick, but it looks like there's upwards of 10. But there's also about 6 more Democrats running, including my favorite, Billy Bob Jaworski, a scrap metal worker, comma, Kennedy assassination conspiracy theorist. You knew that was your occupation, but I never knew that could be your occupation, conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, I think some of it. One of the things about Maryland, and I think in order to file for candidacy, it doesn't take much other than $50 and you fill out a couple forms and you get your name on the ballot. So, and if you look at some of the congressional races, there's a whole list of people running. I know in my district, District 7, I think there's 3 or 4 Republicans running. You tend to get a lot more candidates than you might get in some other states because the bar for candidacy tends to be rather low. And some people, I think, just like to have their name on the ballot in some cases. So it's a...
I just am really sad the guy didn't have a website because I want to see if he's kind of is truly a mix between Billy Bob Thornton and Ron Jaworski. No website, so we don't get to see that. Just thinking about those other congressional races, one that I kind of find interesting is you have Elijah Cummings and Donna Edwards, two African-American congresspeople there, and one seems to be more old-school, traditional Democratic politics, and then Donna Edwards is more new-school, up from the blogosphere. How do you see the way they run both for office and serve as a congressperson is different?
Well, I don't know much about Donna Edwards. She ended up defeating she was one of the few who defeated an incumbent. I'm trying to remember. She beat Albert Wynn, I believe, in a primary. Or actually, now I think about it, I can't remember how that went down. But I think a lot of the Democrats or Democratic blogosphere and liberals weren't big fans of Albert Wynn, and he was defeated, and Donna Edwards became congressman. My congressman is actually Elijah Cummings. I'll tell you, I'm out in Howard County, and I don't know if you ever looked at the congressional districts for Maryland, but they are very, I guess, I don't know what the word is, but gerrymandered beyond belief. And basically, Elijah Cummings, he's, you know, from Baltimore City, and that's his base. Somehow they've carved it out, so I'm in his district. But we always joke, you know, nobody ever sees him until it's election time. Then he mixes one drive out to Howard County, shows up at a candidate's forum, then that's the last time we see him for, you know, until the next election. Because he can basically just run up his victory in Baltimore City. I mean, I think it was 4 years ago, I looked at the numbers, and the Republican candidate could have got 100% out of Howard County, and Cummings still would have won by 30%. So we don't see him too much around here.
How many of these congressional districts are based out or have some part of them in the city of Baltimore?
It's really District 3, District 7, District 2 kind of wraps around the north side of Baltimore. That's actually Bob Ehrlich's old district back before he ran for governor. He was actually somewhat redistricted out of his district, partly I think why he ran for governor in 2002. Because he saw the writing on the wall. They're basically carving up his district, so put enough Democrats in there. So those are really the three districts. Then you have districts 5 and 8, which tend to be the Washington suburbs, where Steny Hoyer is from, and as well as Chris Van Hollen. Those two districts. District 6 tends to be Western Maryland. That's Roscoe Bartlett. He's our lone Republican. And District 1 is out on the Eastern Shore, where tends to be more Republican district. So that's how it kind of breaks down. I guess District 4 kind of gets into Baltimore a little bit as well. But
yeah, because I just think from an outsider's perspective, Maryland, Baltimore is by far the largest population area.
When you look at election results, it's really Baltimore and then the two counties that are considered the Washington, D.C. suburbs, Prince George's County and Montgomery County. I mean, Democrats run up their totals in those three locations. I mean, if you look at the election results, there's Baltimore City and then 23 individual counties, and Republicans can win up to 19 or 20 of those, but there's just not enough people in those to compete with Baltimore and Montgomery and Prince George's County. Kind of where the power lies. So.
Yeah, I think I was just searching for it, and I happen to see red states actually starting to look ahead towards 2012 and redistricting. Any chance there may be a losing or adding of a district for Maryland?
Everything I've read is no. I think we're going to stay where we are. Our population's pretty much stayed steady. We haven't really lost any population. I think we're just keeping up with the average gain elsewhere. So I think everything I've read on that, the expectations will have the same eight districts we've had. And then, I mean, right now the District 6, they basically packed all the Republicans in that district. So I think the Democrats have done a good job of getting it down. So they're almost guaranteed six seats each election, and you know we'll fight over District 1. Back and forth depending on who happens to be the party having the wave that year, and then District 6 will probably be Republican for the foreseeable future. And my guess is Democrats will probably try to keep that same balance of power if they should win the governor, Manchin, or O'Malley happens to win this time around. So it's, and of course, the General Assembly in Maryland is also overwhelmingly Democrat. So, and, Republicans they'll hope to win some seats, but again, the districting, even at the state level, tends to favor Democrats pretty heavily right now. So they've done a good job of packing Republicans in districts. So they, hey, you guys can have this seat, and we'll take all these other seats. So,
yeah. Well, David, I'm going to ask my colleagues any more questions for David Wissing.
I had one, David. You talked about the D.C. suburbs. Is that dominated by government workers, or what makes the Democratic, party so popular there?
I think it's partly demographics. You do have a high minority population, which tend to favor the Democrats in a lot of cases. And there are a lot of government workers. It's one thing, and I always joke, a lot of times you go to some of the Republican events and they talk about, criticizing how big government is and how many government workers there are. And I sometimes have to remind them, I said, you do realize about 40% of your voting base is government workers. It's a little tough to throw all that away right off the bat and then play catch up from there. But being right outside D.C., that's part of it, A lot of the agencies extend out into the suburbs, both the Virginia side as well as the Maryland side. And so you do get a high, even where I live in Howard County, which is about 20 miles north of D.C., you have a lot of government agencies. All their satellite offices tend to extend up this way. And we're right near Fort Meade, which is about to get a huge influx from the BRAC realignment. So it's from a Republican standpoint, and, we always like to talk about smaller government, you're kind of tilting against the windmill sometimes in that respect. So it's a delicate balance sometimes you have to take in that respect.
And David McLaughlin, we have a caller if you'll look at the switchboard.
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to do research. We have somebody from the 404. Welcome, caller. Do you have a call, a question for our guest? Tim, we may be go ahead and getting into our next thing. So let's go ahead. If this is Bob or Jason, stay on the line with us. We'll wrap up this interview before we get to y'all. I think that may be what it is, Tim, actually. Well,
okay.
Well, David, we enjoyed having you on. And, I mean, Tim's just all the time telling us stuff he's learned on your blog. So in a small way, I guess you'd say you have helped make our show better.
Well, I hope so. Like I said, Tim, he puts up with a lot of grief dealing with all the Republican commenters. But he does a good job of it.
Just between you and I, Dave, I love those people. Just don't tell them I said that, okay?
Oh, they might be listening tonight, so.
There we go.
I appreciate you.
Thanks for coming on, and then we'll look forward to following Maryland politics, and maybe close to the general election, may have you stop in with us again and tell us more about what's going on.
Okay, I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks
I'll
a lot.
Keep listening.
Thank you, Mr. Wissing.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and tell you, Tim, thanks for letting David come on with us, and I believe now we are set. We have both our callers, I believe, two calls from the 404, and I know Bob lives there, and I have a feeling Jason does too. Welcome, Jason and Bob.
Hey, how you doing, David?
Can you hear me,
yeah,
David?
Good to have both of y'all. Well, let me kind of set this up. Jason Means is with the Atlanta, the Chick-fil-A Bowl and Chick-fil-A kickoff game. And, of course, that's happening next Saturday down at the Georgia Dome. And Bob Herndon is the president of the Atlanta Barbecue Club. And y'all are going to be having an event as a part of the Chick-fil-A Bowl. Jason, tell us about what that event's going to be.
Yeah, just first of all, appreciate you having us on and taking the time. But we're real excited. Next Saturday we got the third annual Chick-fil-A kickoff game down here in Atlanta. It's a big football game. We got ESPN's College Game Day coming down for the third straight year. We've got two top 20 teams in LSU and North Carolina. You know, it's airing on primetime ABC, so we're real excited for the matchup. And, you know, kind of what we're here for is to talk about the Texas Pete Kickoff Cook-Off, you know, which is a good event. Second year, basically got a bunch of sponsors coming down, you know, doing a lot of sampling, doing some cook-offs, a couple of competitions between fans and famous alumni. So we're real excited about the event. And, you know, Bob's come down with the Atlanta Barbecue Club, and he's been a big part of this as well.
Yeah, and so that's – go ahead, Bob.
Kind of segue to me. I just want to – is it still – is the contest, Jason, is it still open for people to enter, or is it closed off?
No, we've got everything already. So at this point it's closed, but, you know, anybody wants to come out and get some good food, more than welcome to come on down.
Okay. So
yeah.
I think what's exciting about the contest is something to keep in mind. I know they did it last year, but the fact that somebody's going to take home – isn't somebody taking home a green egg?
Yeah, in fact, the winner will take home a big green egg, four tickets to the Chick-fil-A Bowl, full set of cookware, some tailgating chairs, and a prize pack from the Food Network, and that's thanks to a big green egg, Texas Pete, and Comcast.
So it's it's a pretty good deal for somebody. But,
yeah, and I've noticed, Jason, there were so many events happening around this game. To me, it almost had more happening than your average bowl game. What are y'all trying to do with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, with what we can do, we're trying to turn it into like a mini bowl game and a mini bowl week. You know, with the Chick-fil-A Bowl, we operate 30-plus events in December from Christmas leading up to New Year's. And with the bowl game being on New Year's Eve again this year, you know, we're excited about that. But, you know, within what the NCAA will let us do, we're trying to just do as many events as possible and, you know, really program the whole day so that a fan can come out there and just stay the whole day, start at ESPN's College Game Day in Centennial Olympic Park, walk on over to the kickoff cook-off, and then head on over to the fan zone event or the multiple tailgate events we have, and then at 8 o'clock go on in and watch UNC and LSU play a fantastic football game.
Yeah, and I have one more question for you before I pass this thing over to Tim and Catherine for any questions they might have about the game, the event, or the barbecue club for Bob. But I know that in the next few years the College Football Hall of Fame is going to open in Atlanta, real near Centennial Olympic Park, and Dan Cathy, the son of founder Truett Cathy, was a real instrumental in that coming. How do y'all think that's going to impact this kickoff game?
You know, that's a great question. And in the future, you know, it's not set in stone yet, but we've got some real big plans to turn this first week into football into, you know, just a whole festival. So, you know, looking at the enshrinement ceremonies, there's a possibility those could come out there and just, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, just have programming the whole weekend. And, you know, if the College Football Hall of Fame is, you know, able to get a prime spot on or around Centennial Olympic Park, you know, you could just see, you know, one, maybe two football games in the future, have the enshrinement ceremonies, you know, luncheons and cook-offs and events that go along with all of them, and just have a full, you know, Labor Day weekend of programming. So, you know, with the 500,000 visitors per year that the College Football Hall of Fame is expected to bring to Atlanta, I mean, it could just be, you know, an amazing weekend for us in Atlanta.
Yes, well, I tell you what, I looked at it, and I'm looking forward to coming down next week. Bob's invited me to the barbecue event. I'm looking forward to it, but my only criticism is I don't know why you couldn't just pick my two alma maters, Shorter and Georgia State that are playing in the Dome a few days before that. Now they kept these North Carolina and Louisiana teams. Kept in Georgia. But, you know, other than that, it looked good. But
you know, I tell you what,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we can look into that for future years for you. I'll let our president and our scouting team know.
Okay, hey, well,
I'm pulling that department, man. It's going to happen. I feel it. You're talking, we got this thing going. Shorter and Georgia State, man. I feel it.
Yeah. Tim, go ahead with some questions.
One question I had in particular, by the way, I'm a closet lover of cooking, we all watch the big barbecue shows on television that show the big competitions week to week. Is this the type of competitor we're talking about in your particular cook-off?
You know, I don't think it's to that level. I watch a lot of those shows, and some of those things are serious, where they're playing for, you know, $20,000 in prizes and doing whole hog competition and pulled pork and chicken. And, you know, what we've done is we've separated into fan competitions, basically. So, you know, if someone's buying a parking pass and they're coming down, you know, we gave them the opportunity to sign up for one of our three competitions, which is best piece of chicken, best burger, and best steak. And then also we've got the Texas Pete competition that has, you know, six people coming in, cooking basically whatever they want. I mean, whether it's, you know, I think one of them's got tailgate stuffed tenderloin, another one's got some surf and turf. So there's a lot of different options of wings. So that one's a little bit more wide open and, you know, not quite as probably restrictive on some of the rules and the guidelines that you see on TV.
Okay, and Bob, the secret, they say, is in the sauce. So is that what really the judges are going to be looking at in the barbecue portion of the competition?
The judges are going to be judging based on appearance, taste, and texture. So, like, how, you know, and the sauce is part of it, but it's not the only ingredient. Hey, does this look delicious? Yeah, I give it a high score. Does this have a good texture? Does it, you know, is it not too chewy? You know, you can get a piece of steak, and it's really tough. It may taste good, but it's tough, so you lose points. You have three different areas where they'll be looking at and grading accordingly in those three areas: appearance, taste, and texture. And that's, you know, the sauce is part of the taste, but it's not the determining thing. I mean, the Texas Pete thing is important, and there has to be some Texas Pete in there and all the recipes, but it's not the one thing that people are looking for.
Okay, thank you. Catherine?
Hi, guys. I'm not a football fan. I'll just tell you right off the top of my head. But I love barbecue, so I'm excited about this, actually. I just found out about it. And, Tim, I have to tell you, it is not all about the sauce.
Yeah.
All about technique. It's technique and how you use the sauce, but also how you use your grill and how you select your cuts of meat. And so there's a lot in that.
You can't just slap some sauce on something and win a contest.
That's right. You can't put. You can't make a shoe taste good, no matter what sauce you put on. But so, just I'm just learning about this. So where is the actual cook-off going to be? And do you have to have tickets to the game to get to the cook-off?
No, that's a great question. And the cook-off is in the green lot of the Georgia World Congress Center. So it's right there on the west side of Centennial Olympic Park.
Uh-huh.
And it is an absolutely free event. So as soon as ESPN's College Game Day ends at noon, just walk on right on over, maybe 100 yards, 200 yards at the most, right in between the park and the Georgia Dome. You've got the cook-off going on right there from 12 to 5, cooking and sampling all day long.
Okay. That sounds like fun, from 12 to 5. There's a lot going on next weekend. You know, you got, you're fighting against the, you know, Dragon Con and all kinds of stuff, but you never know. You might see some all kinds of crazy dressed up people coming through you might see stormtroopers. You know, there's a whole, there'll be a whole parade of stormtroopers on Sunday. But thanks a lot, you guys. This is really informative. I'm really looking forward to it now. Something to do next weekend.
Great.
Yeah, now, Catherine, don't be making fun of the DragonCon people because she's on a radio show with a guy that...
Oh, I don't make fun of the DragonCon people. I'm going to DragonCon.
Out of the closet and cook in the kitchen. You know, he makes fun of her, so.
No, DragonCon is a blast. I'm going.
I've never been, but I, you know...
Oh, it's a blast. And then we also have the Decatur Book Festival next weekend, so there's a lot going on.
Yeah, well, but I know anytime you can get a channel like ESPN, which is probably like the number one cable network, as far as viewers to come down for an event, I mean, that makes it an event. Is that true, Jason?
Yeah, it does. And like last year when we had the matchup with Alabama and Virginia Tech, and of course Alabama went on to win the national championship and go undefeated when they started with our game, you know, they brought down about 8,000 to 10,000 people just to the college game day. So it was crazy. I mean, it was packed out and college colors everywhere. And you know, the good thing is, knock on wood, right now we're expecting a great forecast for the day, mid to high 80s and completely sunny, so should be a great time.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you one more football question, and based on the event, do y'all think it's better for y'all to have two big out-of-state teams, or I'd heard rumors about trying to get Georgia and Georgia Tech to play in the game as the kickoff to the season with their rivalry game. That would be a bigger deal in the state. But is it better to have the people coming from out of state? What's the advantage?
That's a good question. You know, there's advantages to both. If you have two in-state schools coming, you're going to sell out the game. You have Georgia Tech and Georgia, you know, your game sold out the 10 seconds after you announce it. Now, if you bring in schools like UNC and LSU, they're going to come to Atlanta, stay at one, probably even two nights, especially with the game being on a Saturday night, go to the Aquarium, go to the World of Coke, you know, do all these other events, and that's really where it impacts Atlanta. And, you know, with our games, the bowl game will generate $35 million in economic impact in Atlanta. And with the kickoff game,
wow,
you know, I think we're right at $20, $25 million. So, you know, it's great either way. You know, a lot of times I think your best-case scenario is, you know, looking back, say, at the 2009 Chick-fil-A Bowl where we had LSU and Georgia Tech. You know, you had all those fans traveling in from LSU. Yeah, and all the Georgia Tech fans buying all the tickets up, so it was the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Well, and Bob, I want to give a question to you. We've had you on when you started the Atlanta Barbecue Club, and it has really grown. Tell us about what's happened with the club in the last year or two since you started it.
Well, we're doing – I think the thing we're excited about is the Atlanta Barbecue Festival. We did this last year. We had hoped to do a festival at – and have maybe 20 teams and 20 sponsors and 2,000 people show up. We were aiming for that, and we ended up getting 40 barbecue teams, 40 sponsors, and 5,500 people. And this year we're doing that October 2nd at Atlantic Station, and we're hoping to get 10,000 people. We've already got teams signed up. We've already got 25 or 27 teams signed up, and they – we're way ahead of last year in the number of teams signed up at this point and in terms of sponsorship, and Atlantic Station's doing a great job of promoting us. So we're real excited about trying to get something equivalent to Memphis in May. We feel Atlanta is the crossroads of barbecue. We got all kinds of great barbecue here from North Carolina, Texas, Georgia, and we really want to try to promote Atlanta barbecue and barbecue in Georgia because we think our barbecue's best.
Yeah, well, Bob, that's great work. And I tell you what, I'm going to leave y'all with this one. Is it true that University of Alabama was approached about being this game, but Nick Saban turned it down because he was far too involved in Bessemer City politics? Is that true? I don't know if y'all followed that, but apparently there's a lady that that made the sports shows, not only political shows.
I do have a report on barbecue and politics in Georgia. Can I make a barbecue politics report, David?
If it's the Republicans and Democrats both agree that barbecue's good, I mean, that's a newsflash, Bob.
No,
go ahead.
Y'all know about the Wild Hog Supper, right?
Right.
Yes.
Supper was thrown on by the Secretary of Agriculture, Commissioner Tommy Irvin. And as a responsible barbecue citizen, I have wrote both the Republican and the Democrat. I've sent them both emails asking them to continue this tradition, and I have yet to receive a response from either one of them.
Uh-oh.
We may not have the Wild Hog Supper after Tommy Irvin's gone, and this is a very important issue to the state of Georgia and the people who love pork.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that could be a way they could, instead of having a debate, they could just they could submit their barbecue recipe and people could cook it up, and, you know, that would be better in debate.
Bring this barbecue, the Wild Hog, have them each put, you know, have a Wild Hog cook-off and see which one does best. I think it would be the best way to pick folks anyway.
Yeah, that'd be part of it. Well, Bob and Jason, we want to thank you for coming on the Kudzu Vine tonight, and best of luck for both of y'all's efforts in this event next Saturday.
Hey, David, thank you so much for having us on. We appreciate all you do.
Yeah, thank you very much, and we'll see you out there next week when you're judging and helping out.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we've just had some good guests tonight. We've got just a few more minutes and pretty much a load of topics to cover, but one that I absolutely have to get to is yesterday's election results in Louisiana. David Vitter has heard scandal after scandal. Our guest last week, Stephen Herbwick, he chronicled these. I mean, it was just a systemic pattern of, just kind of a general disrespect for women. You would think the Republican electorate, while they may reelect the man or renominate the man, there would be some turn against him. He got 88% of the vote in a three-person race. Catherine, I'm going to come to you with this one first. Were you surprised?
No.
Okay,
I mean, it comes down to name recognition so often, and it's so hard to predict these things. And I'm sure that he outspent those other two guys by, you know, leaps and bounds. So, people probably didn't even realize who he was, who the other two guys were.
Yeah, but they weren't David Vitter. I mean, that seems like
I know.
Yeah, Tim, what do you think?
Well, look, obviously, this is Louisiana. Candidates and office holders on both sides of the aisle have engaged in these shenanigans down there since in time memorial. I mean, look at Congressman Jefferson with $90,000 in the freezer. And of course, we have Senator Vitter who is in the madam's little black book or whatever. I tell you what, there were more Democrats than Republicans voted in Louisiana. I believe right now this is a 10-point race between Vitter and Melanson. I believe we might have ourselves a race right there. I'm beginning to get a little hopeful. Even in a Republican wave year, we've got a strong candidate in that race, David. I believe right now it's a 10-point race. What do you think?
Well, yeah, and I think that, I mean, if Charlie Molossoff, say, can get most of that 12% of the people that just would not vote for David Vitter, that's a good start right there, closing that gap. And Charlie Molossoff, he is just not the kind of Democrat to me that would be scary to a middle-of-the-road voter at all. There's that theory of, you know, Democratic politics in the South. Secondly, I mean, when Katrina happened, there were a whole lot of people that looked bad. Charlie Molossoff was a guy that looked good. He came up as a leader, and he was in the parish. I mean, New Orleans was terribly hit due to the flood, but as far as the actual hurricane, his district is where the damage was done, and he was so responsive so quick. I have to think under these dire circumstances that he's got a fighting chance.
Yeah,
the one thing he's got going against him. I listen to NPR a lot, and I must have heard his name pronounced like 16 different ways.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Melancon if you're pronouncing it in English. But then I guess in Louisiana, they have a better idea of how to read French names than we do. So,
they know how to pronounce it there.
Benoit said when Benoit.
The big problem the big problem in Louisiana, and our guest last week mentioned it, they're gonna lose a House seat. They've lost population in Democratic areas, particularly in New Orleans, population that has never come back. That may be the deciding factor in this race, don't y'all think?
That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge point. Luckily, I guess Shreveport's a little more Democratic. You would think Baton Rouge might even be a little more Democratic, and then, of course, the city of Houston, which does them no good, but maybe it'll help over there in their Senate, and their governor's race, I should say. Well, guys, it's been a great Kudzu Vine. I want to thank all of our guests, and we'll see y'all in September.
Okay.
All right.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest...